This is the takeaway for Tuesday, July 28th, 2015. This is the takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And what are you worth out there, you American worker, you? Huh? Does your wage come close to what you think you are worth? How much would we pay someone to work at, say, a drive-through fast food place? How much should we pay them?
Would you like to try our new beef and cheese pot pie on a stick, just $1.99 for a limited time only?
Lester.
Honey, it's okay. I want you to be happy. Would you like smiley sauce with that?
Now, actor Kevin Spacey there surely got paid far more to do this scene from the film American Beauty than a real fast food worker would get in life. Is Spacey worth it? What does Spacey get for playing nasty Frank Underwood on House of Cards?
For those of us climbing to the top of the food chain, there can be no mercy.
In such professions, athletics, business, entertainment, the numbers are high and seem just pulled out of a hat somewhere, a hat with a lot of zeros. Is Jamie Dimon at JPMorgan Chase worth the $20 million he got paid in 2014? Or Tim Cook at Apple worth the $9.2 million he got paid? How about Elizabeth Warren, senator? But while at Harvard, she earned as much as $700,000. The Congress and many states are very focused on raising the minimum wage right now. New York has recommended pushing it to $15 an hour. Earlier this summer, Los Angeles passed a citywide minimum wage of $15 an hour, set to go into effect in 2020. Careful, wouldn't want to push it. Seattle, San Francisco, Oakland, Chicago, and Washington, D.C. are among the cities that have either already passed measures or have current proposals in place to raise their minimum wages. But how are these numbers decided? We will raise it enough, but not too much. Oops, that's too much. Small businesses are getting mad. Politicians don't like that. Let's trim it back, trim it back. Whoa. This very random approach to minimum wages does everything but consider if anyone could actually live off that wage. In fact, sometimes it seems we go out of our way to make sure it doesn't provide a living income.
Right now, work doesn't always pay. And we even pay others to make sure it doesn't pay by monitoring those on assistance.
Scott Santens is a writer and advocate for what's called a universal basic income, different than a minimum wage. He's a moderator of the basic income community on Reddit.
If everyone were to start with $1,000 every month as a right of citizenship, that's enough money outside of work to cover our most basic living expenses. Now, consider how a wage negotiation would go with a basic income in existence. Suddenly, $7 an hour may no longer be enough. Why work for $7 an hour when you're already getting $1,000 every month as a new starting point, just for being alive? This right here is possibly the best reason to go with basic income instead of a hodgepodge of minimum wage laws, earned income tax credits, welfare programs, food stamps, tax deductions, and all the rest. Because basic income provides an income floor, there's no longer any reason to keep any of these bureaucracy-filled ways of easing but never-ending poverty.
Ending poverty. Is that the goal? Can the minimum wage do it? Or is it something much bigger? To speak more about how the minimum wage may be beside the point, and in fact how it might actually be helping to keep poor people at the bottom of the economic ladder, here's Tim Hartford, a columnist for the Financial Times and author of The Undercover Economist Strikes Back, How to Run or Ruin an Economy. Tim, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you very much, Tom.
So minimum wage, is it beside the point? Is it meaningful in any way? Or how do you see this?
I think it is meaningful. The recent moves, I think, are risky. It's worth going back about 20 years. So economists used to think it was clearly ridiculous to have a minimum wage because the market would pay you what you were worth economically speaking. You may be worth a lot more as a person, but they would pay you the value of your labor. And if the minimum wage was below that, it would make no difference. And if the minimum wage was above that, well, it would just cause unemployment because employers wouldn't want to pay that. And so people would lose their jobs. So the minimum wage would either be irrelevant or actively harmful. And then what happened was a series of minimum wage laws were introduced in the UK and various US states. Economists looked at their effects and they concluded, actually, it seems to be doing some good. It is genuinely raising people's wages at the bottom, and it doesn't seem to be destroying jobs, or maybe not many jobs. So that was the point at which economists started sort of thinking harder about why this thing works in practice but doesn't work in theory. I should say, all of the experiments so far with the minimum wage have been quite a lot lower than, you know, the $15 an hour that we've been talking about more recently. So just because the minimum wage has been a success so far doesn't mean you can make it $15, you can make it $20, you can make it $50, and you still won't destroy jobs. I guess we'll find out.
Isn't the minimum wage discussion an outmoded debate left over from the point in the industrial economy in the 1960s when, and 50s and 40, you know, most of the 20th century, when a factory wage would pay a living wage and that everyone could buy a house and support a family, the sort of post-World War II economic boom? And that doesn't exist anymore. And we're talking about minimum wages in really an abstraction.
I think you're right, John. I think this is going to sound strange. Whether you are in favor of a minimum wage or not depends on how much you think the future is going to be like Star Trek. So bear with me. So in Star Trek, the robots do all the work, right? So nobody, apart from a few intrepid space explorers, nobody has any economic value to their labor. There's no point in going out and working hard because the robots can do your job better than you can. And in that kind of world, there's absolutely no point in trying to set a minimum wage and say, well, you have to pay people a certain amount an hour because no one's working anyway. A more appropriate policy for that sort of world is where the government just taxes the robots, taxes the output of the robots, and hands out cash to everybody. So a lot of this depends on whether we have confidence that there are lots and lots of good jobs still out there, and all we need to do is to put our thumb on the scale and force employers to be a bit fairer in their negotiations. And I think we really don't know what the answer is. What concerns me is that the minimum wage is a very easy sell politically, because people don't think too much about the risk that it will destroy jobs, and people think, well, employers are going to have to pay it, so it won't come out of my pocket. And when you look at alternative proposals, for example, a universal basic income or a negative income tax, that sounds much more like, you know, paying people for, you know, sitting around smoking dope. It sounds much more like it's going to cost a lot of money for the taxpayer, even though I think a lot of economists would say, well, there's a lot of logic to that kind of approach.
Well, the 21st century, as you've suggested, and Star Trek notwithstanding, may be about this question of work being provided by a source of robots, technology, you know, various kinds of solutions that may or may not involve workers, but there are going to be a surplus number of people on the planet, and that in a sense, economies have to decide how are we going to allow people to live, and that jobs aren't simply the answer for that. That you basically have to come up with some sort of income idea so that people can live, knowing that there are an enormous number of jobs that are not going to be performed by humans in the 21st century. And we really haven't gotten around to thinking of economies in that way, as ways of designing ways for people to live as opposed to paying for people's labor.
I think that's right. I mean, I should say the robots haven't taken all our jobs yet. There are still lots of jobs around, people still working very hard. But it is a possibility. Historically, it's always been the case that if you have been willing to work hard, and as long as you haven't had a severe disability, you would always be possible to go out and make a living. That's especially true since the Second World War. I know, you know, there used to be very widespread poverty before the war. The policy has always been focused on, you know, making sure people are trained to take jobs, people are encouraged to take jobs, you know, employers are encouraged to create jobs. That's always been the focus. You know, people should go out and work. And we haven't got our heads around the possibility, which is still a distant possibility, but it's definitely out there. We haven't got our heads around the possibility that maybe in some future economy, there will be lots of people whose labor has no real economic value. They have value as citizens, they have value as human beings, as voters, but they don't really have any value as workers. And it's kind of pointless to force them to work when in fact we should just be getting a machine, a software algorithm, a robot driver to do their job for them. We have not got our heads around this possibility.
And in fact, the ability of them to live quality lives actually does improve the culture and the quality of our communities in some way, rather than having them struggle in poverty. Before we go, and that's something to think about for the rest of the day, do you think the calculation of minimum wages in places around the world is done any less randomly or in a more sophisticated way for the CEOs who make $20 million, $9 million, $30 million?
Well, the evidence that we have on that, I think, is that that is dependent hugely on what they can get away with. It depends, for example, on whether you have very dispersed shareholders who can't really keep an eye on what the CEO is making, or whether you have maybe a large concentrated family ownership structure who can keep an eye on what the chief executive is paid and make sure it's not too much. There's an awful lot of trying to conceal pay packages in share options, in golden handcuffs, golden parachutes, pension options. So I don't have a great deal of confidence that that system is particularly rational.
So we've gotten away from really gauging the value of work at both ends of the scale.
Maybe it was always an illusion to think that we could ever determine exactly what someone's labor was worth, economically speaking. It looks great in the textbooks, makes for good economic models. Perhaps it was always a little bit optimistic to think that that was going to be possible.
Well, that's something to think about and talk about for the rest of the day. Tim Harford is a columnist for the Financial Times and author of The Undercover Economist Strikes Back, How to Run or Ruin an Economy. Tim, thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
This is Kelly from Omaha, Nebraska. America absolutely needs a living wage. My family does not need much to get by, but the new American dream is the freedom from financial insecurity. I may never be able to buy a home, but I want to live debt-free, have a solid savings plan, have the ability to keep my children and help them through college and retire.
Now that sounds reasonable. What do you think about this? Does America need a living wage? How much do you and your family need to get by?
Hi, this is Denise, and I'm calling from San Diego. In our part of Southern California, our household income of $100,000 puts us in the middle of the middle class. It's enough to get by with two adult children at home and in college, but just barely. We do without a lot of things, things we used to be able to afford, like dental work and eating out. I don't know what the minimum wage would have to be considered a living wage, but no person working full-time should need public assistance to survive.
Orlando, Florida. I don't necessarily support a living wage as it's being applied to the fast food industry. As a small business owner, I know how hard it has been to keep the two employees I have through the downturn, and now that things are slowly improving and I'm underwater, I still can't afford to give them what they identify as a living wage. And if the economy slips again, that would nearly double my staffing costs and would crush the business.
This is Catherine in Dallas, Texas. Only if it is dictated by each individual state, taking into consideration the cost of living in different parts of the U.S., but that's a slippery slope, as it would require each state to decide what is an actual need versus want. What some may only want is what other people decide they actually need. Pay TV, high-speed internet, Starbucks, mani-pedi. Is that a need or a want?
Hi, it's Terry from Portland, Oregon. Yes, I believe we should have a living wage, but I believe it should be tied to the prosperity and related cost of living of each city or demographic area, however that wants to be calculated.
Our economists out there calling 877-8-MY-TAKE to assess what is a living wage and how much do we need it. You can also comment at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com, brain training designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 60 million people worldwide, with personalized training programs to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
Last November, this strange scenario was presented at a local school board meeting in Gloucester County, Virginia. What if boys pretended to be girls and invaded the girls' bathroom?
You're opening up the door, if you allow this to happen, for other things to go wrong. A young man can come up and say, I'm a girl. I need to use the ladies' rooms now. And they'd be lying through their teeth.
Another parent put it more simply or more anatomically.
My son has boy parts. He does not want to be in the bathroom with people with girl parts.
These parents were talking about 16-year-old transgender student Gavin Grimm and his request to be able to use the boys' room at his local public school. In this audio obtained by our partner, the New York Times, Gavin insists that he's not trying to pull a fast one.
I cannot use the women's room, quite frankly, because I am not a girl. I understand that it might be hard for some of you to look past biology and XY or XX. But we do know scientifically that this is not a choice. All I want to do is be a normal child and use the restroom in peace. And I have had no problem from students to do that, only from adults.
The regulation of restrooms as a way of enforcing outmoded stereotypes about gender and race is an old story in America. Joining us is Jennifer Levi, who's director of GLAAD's Transgender Rights Project and a professor at Western New England University. Welcome, Jennifer.
Thanks so much.
And Eli Ehrlich is with us, a 20-year-old rising student at Pitzer College on the West Coast and director of Trans Student Educational Resources. She helped craft California's legislation to prohibit discrimination against transgender students. Eli, welcome.
Hi.
Now, Eli, Gavin Grimm's story sounds familiar to you?
Oh, absolutely. It sounds familiar to a lot of transgender students. I came out as queer and trans when I was 8 years old in the third grade. And like Gavin, I just wanted my identity to be recognized and respected. But my rural Northern California community completely rejected it, and they harassed, assaulted, and isolated me for the next 6 years. And I was not able to use the restroom at school during that whole period. If I had to pee, I had to pretend to be sick and miss class so I could go home.
So you couldn't use either restroom?
No, they didn't allow me to do that. If I went into either of them, I would be called into the office. And if I used, because I'm a transgender woman, if I used the men's restroom, I would face potential assault and criticism from staff. If I used the woman's restroom, I could face suspension and harassment from other students. I was incredibly lucky that my parents became accepting of me when I was 13. They really saw how unhappy I was to not have my gender affirmed and realized that it was time to make a change. And they brought my local community into supporting me. And after that, I realized when I was 16 that I also needed to help make that change around the country. And so I co-founded and became the director of Trans Student Educational Resources.
Now, Eli, let me just back up for a second. You say you came out at 8 years old, right?
That's correct.
But it wasn't until you were 13 that your parents accepted this. That's a long time sitting around in the waiting room having to pee.
Absolutely. Those 6 years were very difficult.
Jennifer Levi, director of GLAAD's Transgender Rights Project and professor at Western New England University. How many communities do you think are grappling with this right now?
The reality is that transgender people live throughout the country and transgender young people exist everywhere. So even communities that don't know that they're grappling with it either are grappling with it or will have to grapple with it. This really is just an issue of non-discrimination and inclusion, and we'll see views change over time.
Now, there are unisex bathrooms for reasons that have to do with all kinds of other issues unrelated to transgender. Although there may be some unisex bathrooms that are transgender as well, it seems to me that we're pretty close to this shouldn't be so hard. Jennifer?
Well, I mean, this shouldn't be so hard because a transgender girl is a girl and a transgender boy is a boy. And that student has to be treated like every other student in the school. But the reality is if you make a student use an isolated, separate restroom, you mark them with a stamp of inferiority and you send a signal to other students that it's okay to treat that young person different than the rest in the school. So, you know, forcing someone to use a separate restroom is also not a solution, but really just accepting students for who they are is in the long term the best for everyone.
I've spent a lot of time around the world, and it seems to me in the United States we have a lot more anxiety about restrooms than almost anyone else on planet Earth. Do you think this gets in the way legally of resolving issues like this?
You know, I think over time what we're seeing is courts and legislatures recognizing that we have to extend full protections to transgender people. And I agree with you that the restroom has really been kind of a focal point of concern in lots of civil rights movements. We've seen it in the gay and lesbian civil rights work. We've seen it in racial justice movements. And we've certainly seen it as a focus of discussion around inclusion of women in the workplace and in all areas of life. So, you know, again, you're right. I mean, we've seen spaces change over time. There are unisex restrooms. You know, we see, for example, changing tables for infant changing areas in men's restrooms, and that's been an important step along the way, too.
Eli, when you first had this issue presented to you, obviously, there is a biological need to go to the bathroom somewhere, right? Did you have a sense of shock or, I don't know, when you went from one gender bathroom to the other gender bathroom, Did you feel as though you belonged in one and clearly not in the other?
I felt incredibly uncomfortable going into the men's room. It did not feel right for me being told I was a gender that I was not. And my middle school didn't even have a unisex restroom. That wasn't an option for me. While we should expand unisex restrooms, we should not be put in restrooms or should not be forced into restrooms that do not conform to our gender identity rather than sex assigned at birth.
Well, this is certainly an issue that is not going to end this year. And it's interesting how both of you have, dealt with this. And in your case, Eli, for quite some years now, Eli Ehrlich is a 20-year rising student junior at Pitzer College. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Also, Jennifer Levi is director of GLAAD's Transgender Rights Project and professor at Western New England University. Jennifer, thanks so much.
Yep. Thank you.
Support for The Takeaway comes from TIAA CREF, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org.
He's the doctor who always is in the office, always making house calls.
My name is Sarah. I'm calling from Portland, Oregon. My favorite Dr. Seuss book is Oh, the Places You'll Go. I love reading it to my boys, ages 6 and 10, because it reminds us that life has ups and downs, fun and adventure, and lonely lost times. However, those peaks and valleys are essential for finding out who you are. We always have a short conversation after reading it about what in their life lately has been fun and what may have been challenging.
That's great, Sarah. Donna writes us on Facebook, one fish, two fish, red fish, blue fish. Love it. Shows how great we are at being different, but all together in the world. My gang at home in the Hockenberry house loves The Lorax. And now there's a new Dr. Seuss book coming out, found in the Good Doctor's papers. This story gives us some insight into Theodore Geisel, his real name, into his creative process. The title of this book says it all, though. What pet should I get?
I've been asked many times what was his favorite. First of all, he liked each, and he was like a father. He liked all his children. He loved every single thing. Horton, the little Lorax. I can't think of anything that he didn't love.
Oh, that just gives me goosebumps. That's Dr. Seuss's widow, Audrey Geisel, speaking some years ago. But not all the lovely ideas did get published, as the sheer size of the Seuss archive suggests. But What Pet Should I Get has that Seuss rhyme and simplicity of a classic. Seuss almost to the point that you can't believe it hasn't already been published. What pet should I get? Oh, sure, I must have read that. I loved it as a kid, right? But it was actually found in the writer's papers 2 years ago, more than 20 years after his death. Will this be some revisionist Seuss, akin to the disappointing revelations about Atticus Finch, a racist in Harper Lee's Go Set a Watchman? For instance, Dr. Seuss's What Pet Should I Put in the Clothes Dryer? Not likely. Kathy Goldsmith is Vice President and Associate Publishing Director at Random House and Dr. Seuss's former art director. How Dr. Seuss got his ideas is one of those gifts and mysteries we can't ever solve. But, Kathy, tell us something about how those ideas were sorted. When did Dr. Seuss know when to pursue one idea over another?
Well, I can't really answer that for you because he often had more than one idea that he was working on at a time. And we generally didn't see ideas until he was pretty sure he had finished working on them.
So he was always bringing you gold.
Well, I wouldn't want to say always, but yes, when he brought us something, it was gold.
Wow. What do you think of this particular book? What Pet Shall We Get?
I'm thrilled about this book because it gives us an eye back into the time when he was at his most creative. Mm-hmm. It's the late 50s. I think it actually dates to 1959, if I had to guess. I think it comes right before one of the titles you just mentioned, One Fish, Two Fish. That was a time when Ted was publishing two books a year for a number of years on end and putting other things aside and moving on. So I think it comes from quite a fertile time in his writing career.
And of course, like Dr. Seuss, you know, it's not what pet will we get or what pet do I want? It's what pet should I get? And it's just sort of this idea that every child is different, has a different set of values, and that the choice of a pet is going to tell you something about yourself. That was his sort of genius. Does the book deliver on that?
I think it does, because like so many of the other Dr. Seuss books, while we're nominally talking about choosing a pet, we're really talking about making choices, which is something that all of us, children and adults, do all throughout our lives. Sometimes it's easier than others, but we do have to make choices.
We don't want to be a spoiler here, but are these pets like dogs and cats, or are they imaginary animals like, you know, wiggle giraffe worm things? You know,
well, in this book, we actually have some of each, but it is more rooted in the real life animals mm-hmm. than it is in the imaginary animals.
A long book? Is this a toss-off? Is this something that maybe hints that he didn't want it published?
I think it's – no, it's not actually a long book. It's one of his shorter books. But I think if you think about its relationship to One Fish, Two Fish is very instructive here. I think that Ted moved directly from writing this book, inspired One Fish, Two Fish. There's a portion of this book that does deal with imaginary pets, and I think that part of the story – took Ted's imagination, and he spun off almost instantly into One Fish, Two Fish, which just became a much bigger, longer project than this one was. And so I think he just took his attention away from this one.
Well, that's interesting, because you're suggesting that he was toying with this idea of pet relationships. Mm-hmm. And then he said, we can make this a much bigger relationship. And really, his whole oeuvre goes in this direction of kids having relationships with all kinds of fantastic animals.
Yes, exactly.
Wow, so this might be a turning point, a real pivot, this whole idea.
I think so. So, yeah.
So will this be for little kids or maybe later readers? What do you think?
Oh, I think it's for little kids. We generally say 4 and up at Random House, but I think you could read it to a younger child. You could read it to an older child.
How, I guess, special was it to work with him? There's really no one else.
Well, like, clearly not. Yeah. It continues to be the high point of my career, and mostly because he was such a mentor and such a teacher to me. I learned most of what I know about children's picture books from him. Mm-hmm. Also what I know about color and about pacing for a book.
And who in publishing gets an entire life career with the one person who is so deeply connected to readers around the world?
Not very many people, I'm sure.
Yeah. Well, you're lucky. You think there'll be another one?
I don't think so.
All right. Well, Kathy Goldsmith, keep looking.
I will. We certainly will.
Vice President and Associate Publishing Director at Random House and Dr. Seuss's former art director. You can see images and original markups from What Pet Should I Get? Just visit thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Do you have a favorite Seuss book? On Facebook, John writes, Horton Hears a Who, because it taught me to be outraged by social injustice. I'm dismayed, of course, that when the mediocre movie version came out, the Right to Life movement co-opted its message. Well, you'll get over that, John. Andrew writes, One Fish, Two Fish, Red Fish, Blue Fish reminds me of my grandparents who had this book from when my mom was a girl. I've always loved reading it. How every page you turn, you see a new little world. Join the conversation. Tell us about the worlds you've experienced through Dr. Seuss. Visit us on Facebook.com/The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Curious.com, committed to helping people learn more than 15,000 skills like Swedish, statistics, and sword fighting. Curious.com. Grow your skills. Learn more at Curious.com/PRI.
There are struggling musicians, and then there are musicians who can't imagine what else there is to do with their lives.
I haven't really changed much since we started, you know, playing together when we were in seventh grade, you know, or at least it doesn't feel like I'm.
The ex-ambassadors are 4 young, inseparable musicians who can still imagine they are in someone's basement, just jamming away. What was possibly noisy to parents and neighbors years ago, though, has turned into a marketable musical skill. Their latest album aims to bring all of us into the basement with them to hear some fine songs about family and friendship and the music that glues them all together. Sam Harris and his older brother Casey are joined by bass player Noah Feldshuh and drummer Adam Levin. Sam wants to thank his parents for all of this.
I think we were lucky to have parents that basically, as long as we were able to make a living and were happy in life, they were pretty much happy with our paths in life. They never tried to push us necessarily in one direction or the other. And, you know, they completely, you know, when they saw that music looked like that it was going to be the direction, you know, they were probably reluctantly, but they, you know, they got totally behind us, you know, on that. And, you know, and they've just been fingers crossed that we could actually make a living at it, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think also a part of their generation, you know, they so fiercely, you know, went left and did their own things. And, you know, my dad left home very early, and my mom decided to become a folk singer, and, you know, which both, you know, my dad was a writer for years and years until he became a publicist, and all
so there were
careers.
Lots of examples for failure.
I think when they knew that we were going to become musicians, they're like, all right, they're probably going to fail too. It's great, you know, just let them play.
What is the combination of your personalities and your style that really seems so attractive to so many different people who have used your music, who have, you know, sort of sampled your music, who have, you know, anything from commercials to other artists?
You've got a pretty eclectic style, I guess. I mean, that's probably a product of all of our, you know, personalities and all the, you know, the various musical backgrounds we've all come from, you know. It always seems to come together to make a very wide-ranging selection of music, which I think has helped us a lot along the way.
Yeah, I think also with in movies and when, you know, movies and commercials where brands are, I think our approach to music is very genuine, and we're never writing songs with a product in mind or with getting syncs, you know, placements in TV and film and commercials and stuff. We're never writing with that really in mind. And I think that kind of genuine approach kind of comes through in the music.
I mean, as big of a platform as the internet is, you know, sometimes blogs just don't take to certain bands or, you know, or whatever. Like, we didn't really find internet acclaim and the simple nature of the music industry right now, where, you know, it's kind of impossible to make money selling your music. That's a way for bands to survive. It's a way for musicians to survive. And I think people are kind of becoming more aware of that, the general public.
What was the pitch from Rihanna's folks? I mean, how'd you get a piece of that action?
That was it's a good piece of action to be part of, man.
Yeah.
I had started this chorus over a beat that he had sent me, and we worked on the chorus for about 6 months. America, and she really took to it, really liked it, and then after she said she wanted to use the song, I helped put words to the verses, you know, for this concept. Yeah, it was a real labor of love, man. It was like a year in the making.
Do you have to do that all the time on like a corporate jet when you're
Oh man, if we were on a corporate jet, yeah, we totally would. But
it's funny though. I do write a lot of my stuff on, you know, while we're traveling in our van. Like, most of our record was recorded on my laptop into my little Duet and into an SM58.
All of us, I mean, even Adam, you know, now has a lot of, you know, great samples of, you know, his drums and stuff, and he can program a lot. So I don't even know. For the next album, we may not even go into a studio at all. We may end up just recording everything literally on the road on our laptops, you know. Run away here with me. Lost souls in reverie.
This project is about you growing up, becoming adults.
Yeah.
You say that very openly. I mean, you know, two generations ago, I mean, rock and roll musicians, it was like, you know, I want to be dead by 30.
And it was all mystery. You didn't want to talk about your childhood.
A lot of suspicion about adulthood.
Yeah. Yeah.
We haven't really changed much since we started, you know, playing together since we were in seventh grade, you know, or at least it doesn't feel like it. We really just wanted to, with our first fully, you know, thought out piece that we were putting out in the world, wanted to have it be as
honest
and as solid of a representation of who we are and where we come from as possible. And that led to finding the clips from the home movies and from, you know, footage when we were teenagers and a young band starting out when we were in our early 20s.
How and where will you be in 2015? Now, that's 15 years from now. You'll be 26.
I will not be here. Hmm? I'll be away from you guys. Far away.
We may follow you.
You do when you die.
You know, showing people who we are, that's, you know, honestly, that's what people get down with these days. They want to know who, you know, artists and all that are on a personal level. And
yeah, I mean, obviously the thing is we still have no idea who we really are.
Yeah.
You know, and that's a big part of it too. It's just the exploration of it that, you know, we want to continue.
The band is called Ex-Ambassadors. Band members Sam Harris, his older brother Casey, Noah Feldschuh, and Adam Levin all joined us in the studio. Their new album, VHS, is out now. And here's something to take with you today. The Boy Scouts ended their ban on openly gay adult leaders yesterday, 2 years after allowing openly gay scouts. Until yesterday, gay scouts had to leave when they turned 18. After yesterday's announcement, organizations with strong stands against gays, including the Mormon Church, said they were still deciding whether they would stop supporting scouting. But scout leaders say they are looking way beyond this controversy. They say what worries them most right now are young people increasingly urban and overscheduled who don't really care about what types of merit badges they can earn. The uniform may be a problem, guys. Just saying. That's all for today. Thanks for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.